very high-tech project here. Try to find a way to put that recorder so it doesn't slide down. So tonight, as promised, I'm going to offer a talk on forgiveness, which is quite a subtle topic. And I think to really speak to this very well, one has to consider what's called sampajana, which means clear comprehension. It's a particular form of mindfulness that takes a kind of panoramic view of things and looks at things like the suitability of the means for the problem at hand, and considers the big picture of what's being discussed, because it's only from looking at the big picture of what's being discussed that you can come to any kind of wisdom on this particular topic. So we've been doing a lot of talk these few days about metta, and of course this is a very important quality for a number of reasons. You know, it's got its own power and benefit, and it's also the source of other states which have a positive nature. And for those of you who are old timers in this meditation thing, you'll know that there are actually four attitudinal practices that can be done, three of which are offshoots of metta. So metta, the first, is the root of the other three. But in addition to metta, there is the practice of compassion, karuna. Then there's the practice of what's called empathetic or sympathetic joy, mudita. And then the last of these practices is the practice of equanimity. So, upekkha. So these four qualities together are called the Brahma-viharas, and this word vihara refers to abode. It's saying these are the divine abodes. And it's a figurative way of saying that if this is really well developed in the heart and mind, in a certain kind of way, you could say that a being comes to dwell in this particular attitude of mind. This is their spiritual home, not in the literal sense of having a castle named metta, but in terms of it being where they dwell internally, that this is where their heart and mind resides. So metta is the first of these, and then the second of these, karuna or compassion, is the action of metta when it meets suffering. So it's an organic movement of the heart which wishes for suffering to cease, wishes to be of aid to self or others when suffering is there. And this, contrary to what one might believe, is actually not a suffering state in and of itself. It can touch suffering and desire to relieve it, but it isn't dragged down into the depth of suffering by exposure to suffering. So compassion is very powerful. And the state of compassion in and of itself is a pleasant state, even though we know that suffering is unpleasant, and connecting with suffering of another is not necessarily pleasant. But compassion comes in and wraps the whole situation with this beautiful quality of tenderness of heart. It's not overwhelmed by what it experiences. So the third of these Brahmaviharas, mudita, is actually the quality of heart that recognizes the joy and happiness and good fortune that another may have, and finds happiness and joy itself in that recognition or that acknowledgement. So a way to put it would be, you see something good happening for somebody else. You see their enjoyment or their success in any number of ways. And instead of your mind getting lost in comparison or envy or jealousy, instead the heart opens in happiness and enjoyment and pleasure itself at the realization that somebody else has something good going for them. And that mudita is a really beautiful quality of mind. And interestingly enough, of the four Brahmaviharas, it's actually the one that's most difficult to cultivate because it brings us closer into a direct comparison of self and other often. But it's a favorite topic of mine. I love this state. So the last of the Brahmaviharas is something called upekkha or equanimity, where caring becomes deeply wise and stable in a kind of manner that allows for balance and letting go. So there's still caring there, but there's a kind of grounding with equanimity, so it doesn't get pulled into unbalance or get pulled into the near enemies or the far enemies of these other three states I've just mentioned. So the four together provide skillful tools for just about any condition for human beings. So we've got the developed capacity to care and to respond to suffering, joined with cheering on happiness and letting go of extremes to remain balanced. So these are all important and powerful internal assets that we deploy when we're addressing this question of forgiveness. Because this topic of forgiveness actually requires the pragmatic application of metta, karuna, and upekkha in particular, along with panya, wisdom. So you've noticed for yourself, being on retreat, that it's pretty common to have difficult states of mind arise. That's one of the reasons I always try to clue people in at the beginning of a retreat that they will experience a range of emotional states, because I think it's important to normalize that, because often when people think about going on a retreat, you know, it can sound like, well, retreat, that sounds great, you know, I'd be in this nice place and somebody would cook food for me and, you know, I'd be quiet and I'd be able to unwind and, you know, I won't have to clean and well, you know, that part of it's true, but as we know, when you come on retreat, you come with your own mind and your own mind stream, and you know, stuff that was out there comes right in with you very often. So some of the suffering that arises on retreat can be in relationship to past experience where either we've been harmed or someone we've caused harm to another person. And sometimes these thoughts and emotions and memories can arise in a surprising, unexpected review of something that we've assumed was long ago forgotten and past. Or maybe it's something that we're consciously aware of that we carry in our heart that hasn't been healed, hasn't been let go of. So in this case, we could still consciously carry and often refer to this kind of suffering experience. And even if the event was a long time ago and it's not happening anymore, it's still possible that we are suffering in relationship to it now. So what to do about this? You know, how can we think about this phenomenon arising on retreat or in daily life and include it in our practice? And this is where I think we really requires like a big picture thinking and understanding about this topic of forgiveness. So if we were to imagine, for instance, a circumstance where There was no way to be discontinuous with past errors or harm, where if something has happened in the past that's been painful or hurtful, and it just keeps echoing and echoing and echoing and echoing and echoing and maintaining its power to cause distress in real time, that would be a situation of deep suffering. Because under those sorts of circumstances, error would sort of inexorably lead to error, right? If you have that feeling like you're under attack, or you've done something horrible, and the mind can't find any kind of free or wholesome relation or empowered or wholesome relationship to that, you're basically in the dukkha trap, and that's where you're going to stay. So there needs to be an emphasis on finding some way to stop it or to rectify this suffering or to clean it up. Because otherwise, it would just resonate until at some point, due to the truth that things have a natural half-life, it would at some point diminish. But maybe not anytime soon. So, you know, what can we do to kind of hurry this kind of dukkha or hurry this kind of suffering on its way? That's really the question, right? So I think one of the things that makes this topic so tricky in casual conversation is that we don't really have a common definition about what forgiveness is, right? Mm-hmm. Don't you think that's part of it? Forgiveness. I mean, what is it? What does it mean? What are you even talking about? We've got a lot of associations with the word. So I'll tell you first what I think it is, what definition I've come to. And I think this is original, but you never know. You know, if you hear a lot of teachings and read a lot of teachings. But I think this is original, or at least somewhat original. So what I think it is the process of developing a skillful, unstuck relationship to the past harmful actions of ourselves or others. This involves choosing the intention to forgive in order to end a suffering relationship to the story, to the people involved, and to current arisings which are related to it. It's a way to let go, disengage from continued harm, from entanglement with suffering. So I see this as having a lot to do with letting go of the attachment to this particular event and learning how to have a skillful relationship to the present echoes or manifestations that might be arising in real time. So, and I want to clarify some of the other associations that can come up for us when we're thinking or talking about forgiveness, because there are a lot of them, and some of them are, in my opinion, quite inappropriate, and some of them contradict each other. So there's a lot of different words and feelings that can arise when we think about forgiveness. And here are some. Acceptance, letting go. Regret, remorse, guilt, shame. Resistance, anger, withdrawal, rage, fear, judgment, condemnation. Freedom, peace. Acceptance, renewal, reconciliation. That's an interesting one right there, reconciliation. More on that topic later. Duty, obligation, putting on a false face, denial, liberation, detachment, release, letting somebody get away with it. Right? Aren't those all kind of things that tend to be associated with this word forgiveness? which is why it's so difficult to have a common conversation about it. So let's take a look at the reasons that we would want to practice forgiveness. Well, we can start with the First Noble Truth version, which is there's suffering in life, and sometimes we cause it, and sometimes we have suffering inflicted upon us, and sometimes both of these things are true. Sometimes we're directly responsible for our own or other suffering, but then sometimes suffering just happens in the course of life, right? I mean, you could be the most meticulous, most morally developed, most caring, careful person that has ever existed, and you would still sometimes in the course of your life hurt somebody. Isn't this true? Even if it was just something like, no, I don't want to marry you because I just don't feel it, you know? You know what I mean? Just acting out of honesty and integrity and with, you know, the best of intentions to protect yourself as well as the other person, you could still do something to hurt somebody or harm somebody. You know, if you compete for a job and you get it, well, you know, that means somebody else didn't get it. I mean, if you walk outside on your way to the dining hall, you know, there's ants on the ground that you can't see. I mean, there's no way to be perfectly harmless, even though we can work in the direction of having harmlessness as our intention and aligning our actions with that intention. But we can't completely eliminate this samsaric feature of life, which is, you know, just another example of the truth, the First Noble Truth. So sometimes suffering just happens in the operation of life. Now, I've talked a little bit earlier about particular ways in which the body can respond when there's been a certain history of the nervous system being overwhelmed. We'll call it trauma. So, but even if we don't have trauma, our body-mind system is geared to notice suffering and to try to avoid it, right? This is job number one for all sentient beings, which is to stay alive. And we're set up for this. You know, the mate seeking, the food seeking, the, you know, all the other, the being careful about, you know, who's around dark corners. I mean, this is all survival-based thing. This is job number one for humans is to survive. And it's inborn, and it's a very deep drive. So we're geared to notice suffering and to try to avoid it. So now here's an evolutionary paradox for us, though. So the way that we sometimes respond to injury and suffering is to never let ourselves forget it and to keep it alive. Right? We're just like trying to make sure that doesn't go down like that again, right? We're trying to keep that from happening again, consciously or unconsciously. So, you know, our memory gets involved there. Okay, we've got to remember this, you know. Last time you were driving over here, you know, that particular off-ramp, you know, that's where that guy hit you, you know, whatever it is. So, you know, we're set up to keep this alive. And in an extreme example of this would be that difficult memories are stored in a particular way, a different way than non-traumatic ones. So, for instance, they're stored with lots of alarms and flashing red lights that tell our heart, body, mind to watch out. You better take care. You know, what happened might happen again. And the result can be a kind of easily startled and easily revived fear, anger, fear response when something happens that's even remotely associated with the original events. Right? And those of us who have had traumatic experiences, you kind of know that, right? So it's almost like the system says, well, you know, don't forget. You better be careful. You better be on guard. You better be prepared because, you know, it could happen again, you know. I don't know, red was the color of the car that hit you on that ramp. You know, there's a red car. And yet, keeping our past suffering alive to help prevent future suffering is a suffering in and of itself, is it not? I mean, it might be biologically well-intended, you know, to keep to ensure our physical survival, but keeping suffering alive to help prevent future suffering is a suffering in and of itself. So the question is, how can we break the hold of suffering and our attachment to it? How can we open the mind to the possibility of freedom, of living in the present with wisdom, with the past taking its place as the past? Right? So how do you do that? So this, I think, is the territory we're in when we're talking about forgiveness. So reflecting on this, you can see the wisdom of forgiveness practice, because unskillful actions, whether they're our own or somebody else's, can otherwise create a kind of cul-de-sac where we're locked into an unwholesome relationship with the present suffering caused by those deeds, right? We're kind of loyal to it in a certain kind of way. So there can be a kind of unskillful fusion to the very source of this suffering, whether it's a person or an event or an action. So there needs to be a way to break loose from this round and round of dukkha, which sometimes can seem to even defy the law of impermanence. So, because the alternative is maintaining a tie of aversion to a person or situation which has caused harm. And isn't that what we're really talking about when forgiveness is not available? We think we're protecting ourselves from this thing that has happened, but in a certain kind of way, we're bonded to it, right? We're bonded to it by this reaction of aversion. Every time we think about the person or the situation or remember it. So without the capacity to move forward and to let go and let things change, we can actually be fused to our most painful experiences and closed around them, which is a state of being stuck, of suffering. So the Buddha had some interesting things to say about this topic in the Dhammapada. And there's a section in there called Choices. And in it, the Buddha reflects on the two different ways a person who had been harmed by another might use their own capacity for reflection. And he says one of these ways deepens the suffering, and one of them leads to more freedom of mind and liberation. So this is from the Dhammapada. Look at how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Look at how he abused me and beat me, how he threw me down and robbed me. Notice that's all past tense. This is the person in the present sense saying this, reflecting back on it. And the Buddha says, live with such thoughts and you live in hate. So there's the original thing that happened and the harm that was done from that. But now the mind has picked this up and is relating it to it in a way that revives the harm or the sense of injury every time it thinks about it. So, you know, or maybe our own version might be something like, well, I screwed up in this particular way and I, you know, I did damage and I need to keep punishing myself for it because I'm a bad person. Right? Isn't that another version of the same thing? Only inner directed. So, forgiveness is a way out of entanglement, entrapment in the wreckage of past unskillfulness. It's a way out of entrapment in the wreckage of past unskillfulness. It's a way to begin again, to unstick what's been adhered to, suffering and judgment. It's a way to thaw what's been frozen and begin to let things move again, to release, and in the process to open choices and options other than being chained to a cycle of reactivity, to a memory of past experience. So a first thing to know about this is that it's a process. Right? We can't just do it by an act of will. Because if we could do it by an act of will, very often we would have done it already, right? So I would say even kind of be careful of, be cautious of, kind of like easy forgiveness, easy grace. Because I think when there's been real harm, I don't think there's easy grace. I think there's work. No, unless you're Jesus. But maybe he was faking it, I don't know. But it's important to know forgiveness actually is a process. So it's not an act of will, although the intention to forgive is essential to begin the process. So the intention to forgive is part of a decision, a choice coming from wisdom. And the decision is to no longer attach to the present moment results of the unskillful actions of ourselves or others. Right? So if we understand that it's in our interest to let go, to no longer insist on ignoring a truth or telling ourselves the story in a way which gives us so much suffering and which disempowers us. Right? So this could start with like the intention to work with this. And I've got to say here too, timing is everything in this regard, right? So we have to be ready for the undertaking, and there has to be enough stability of heart and mind and enough safety to undertake this often challenging practice. So there has to be safety there, right? So, you know, trying to forgive. For instance, in an earlier part of my life, I did a lot of work around domestic violence. And, you know, often for women who were in the shelter, that, you know, they didn't have any other place to stay. And often they were being pressured by, you know, people around them, like members of the extended family, and certainly often the spouse to, you know, reconcile. And, you know, there are a lot of promises being made sometimes and all the rest of this. And there was often religious encouragement to forgive and reconcile, right? And this was always very interesting to hear because, you know, very often, most of the time, the violent partner could not be considered a religious or spiritual person in the normal usage of the term, and yet they seem to have particular biblical verses with which they felt at home, one of which was, wives be subject to your husbands, and the other one was, you should forgive each other 70 times 7 just as Jesus forgave whoever, or something along those lines. I think I've blotted it out. But so, like, compulsion forgiveness is not forgiveness, right? If you have to say, yeah, I forgive you because the kids and I don't have any place to live unless we go home with you. That is not forgiveness, right? That's not what we're talking about. How could that possibly be genuine? Because one of the basic conditions for being able to begin to undertake this work is that of safety. And there's no safety there, right? There's no safety there. So that's a kind of patch it up and, you know, try to smooth over the surface of it and, you know, just kind of like continue on around the wreckage and in a deluded thought that somehow it's going to be different going forward when nothing has ever really been addressed. Nothing is different there. So sometimes it's premature to consider forgiveness. Sometimes we're still too involved with the original injury, we're still bleeding. So when it's like this, you obviously have to tend to yourself and to restore your own well-being and safety first, right? That is not the time to go into some commitment to some process to get over it, when really what you should be doing at that time is taking your care and attention and metta and compassion and all those things and applying them to you. Right, not taking on any more arduous advanced practices, which is what forgiveness can be. Right, you have to take care of yourself first. This is common sense, but as I said, there can often be a lot of pressure to make nice. Right, make nice or shut up. So often we begin the process of forgiveness in a very gradual way. Gradually. So you might begin, for instance, by entertaining the possibility that we might at some point consider maybe forgiving. Right? Maybe sometime I might think about it. It's within possibility later on down the road if I feel like it. Right? That is actually a step, right? Because there the mind isn't like immediately closed, like, no fucking way, not now, not never. Right? And it can be like that when you're still feeling unsafe and, you know, the hurt is still very deep and you're feeling very wounded. That's not the time to try to, like, talk yourself into that. That kind of reaction is a sign that you need to take care of yourself. You need to do the work that's necessary to restore or create a sense of safety and equilibrium internally. Because that other state, that's doesn't have the tools to be able to grapple. That's the system totally shut down in self-defense, as might be appropriate at that time. Right? Because as I said earlier, job number one is always to take care that you survive. So that can actually be a wholesome evolutionary reflex. Okay? So even being able to entertain this possibility that you might at some point consider maybe thinking about forgiving, that can be a really big step for somebody. Since the tendency in these situations can be to paper things over and to minimize, it's really important that we not cooperate with delusion in that regard. Okay, so it's actually important to acknowledge error wisely, because forgiveness doesn't mean denial. It doesn't mean we minimize the damage done or blur accountability. Au contraire, in my opinion. So there's a quote I came upon by the author Elizabeth Gilbert. You know who she is? Eat, Pray, Love. Okay. So she had a long-term relationship with a woman named Rhea Elias, who sounds like she was quite the being. So Rhea has now passed away, but this is what Gilbert said about her. Here is her mantra on truth. Quote, "The truth has legs. It always stands. When everything else in the room has blown up or dissolved away, the only thing standing will always be the truth. Since that's where you're going to end up anyway, you just may as well start there." Right? Because the bullshit does wash away at a certain point, and if things haven't really been addressed, the spackle's going to come off the fix-up job, and it's still going to be there. So it's important to acknowledge the harm done. And upon examination of situations where forgiveness is in question, comes up as a question, it's really important to acknowledge that in many cases, the original harm was done when basic sila, non-harming, was forgotten or ignored. That is, unskillful actions of body, speech, and mind cause damage. Right? There's a reason for those precepts, or in other schools of teaching the Ten Commandments, or you know, whatever the behavioral codes are. Because if you don't observe those minimums, it's like invitation to a multi-car pileup, right? They're like the basic baseline standards for living a life that doesn't cause harm. And very often in these circumstances where we're thinking about whether forgiveness is in order, the whole train wreck happened because these basic kinds of commitments to non-harming weren't observed. So it's good to be clear about responsibility. So can we acknowledge what we've done in ignorance and or what somebody else has done? So there's this whole piece about not letting the harm go unexamined. So we can learn to avoid harm by considering how the unskillful actions arose in the first place, what the causes and conditions were that led to the wrong action. In other words, to bring the power of reflection there in order to seek understanding. So to take an example of circumstances where deep examination about how harm was caused did not happen. Let's take an example of the Catholic Church and all of the sexual abuse things that happened within that community, and for how many years it went on with individual members of the clergy, you know, having multiple victims. Well, the sila rules in that community are really clear, and they're really strict, right? Like, the rules are clear about what you're supposed to be doing and what you're not supposed to be doing, especially if you're, say, a priest. So there's not any lack of clarity about the rules and what the standards were, but it's the whole institution was completely unwilling to take a deep look at what harm was actually done and what the circumstances were within the denomination that allowed that to go on and continue, right? So they didn't, they had an overlay of a weak and improper critique in terms of causation. So they weren't really willing to take responsibility and to acknowledge the harm and consider how the action arose in the first place and what the causes and conditions were that allowed it to happen and allowed it to persist. So they didn't do that. So that's why it's important to do that. Because there may be some things going on that actually require the uprooting of some of those attitudes and some of those ways of being and some of that framework. So it's important to reflect, well, how did this come about, actually? What was going on when this harm happened? Okay, let's see. I was not feeling good. I had 5 beers. I didn't eat dinner. Right? I got in the car. Right? To own it in a certain kind of way. To own it. So in the middle length discourse to Rahula, who's the Buddha's son, the Buddha told his son Rahula that in order to purify thought and action, we need to recognize and admit mistakes. And interestingly, he encouraged Rahula to acknowledge the unwholesome action to his teacher. He said to open it and then undertake restraint for the future. To open it, which is a whole other thing than just slapping on a Band-Aid, right? Slap on a Band-Aid and carry on. Oh yeah, I did that bad here. Yeah, that's okay. So to actually investigate. So there's a whole piece here also about remorse and remedy. So in the case of our own unskillful actions, we identify what we did which was unskillful. And by opening to the harm which caused it, we allow ourselves to feel why we don't want to do something like that again. Right? So there's a certain kind of way in which it's very beneficial to let it land in our consciousness about what actually happened. Right? And that can be painful for us to realize that, right, to recognize that, which is one of the reasons that we often tend to want to, you know, brush stuff away or to minimize it. So but by opening to the harm it's caused and by feeling why we don't want to do something like that, we can actually feel wholesome regret and resolve with a sincere heart not to repeat the error. Because we say, okay, I don't want to do that again. That was not skillful. That caused harm. I don't want to do that again. And back it up. Because our recognition of the harm has become conscious. So in order to make that kind of renewed commitment to non-harming, we need to let register the painful nature of the outcome of unskillful actions. So then, if it's appropriate, we take specific steps to refrain from or protect from future harm to ourselves or others. So this might involve something like getting psychotherapy or joining a 12-step group or going into some of the recovery program, right? Because if we've looked at the causes and conditions that were present there when, you know, this thing happened, and we take a look and say, well, you know, I just was feeling so much emotional distress, I just wanted to get blotto every chance I got because I couldn't handle it. That's telling you, right, that you probably need psychological support and you need to stop getting blotto. So there may be other things that you need to do in relationship to the situation. So, if appropriate, which is a big qualifier, right, we could make amends or restitution or allow somebody else to make amends or restitution. Do you ever have the experience of having something happen in relationship with somebody else, like years ago, and at some point they show up again? Ever had that? It's easier to happen these days, isn't it? With, you know, all the social media stuff, people can kind of track you down more easily. I had an interesting thing like that happen where somebody I worked with 35 years ago or something showed up via telephone call. Hi, this is da-da-da. Do you remember me? And my first reaction was, Oh yeah, I remember you. You almost got me fired. I sure do. But I thought, oh, this is interesting. I said, yeah, I do. And the person proceeded to say, well, you know, I'm calling up because I'm in recovery now, and you know, part of our program for recovery is basically to contact people that we've harmed when we're using substances and make amends to them. You could have knocked me right off the chair. It was like, boom! It's like... And so, you know, what could you do? But, I mean, my heart just went, whoo! And I felt this sense of relief that I didn't even... this weight I didn't even realize I'd been carrying in relationship to this particular person and the memories that came up every time they would, you know, flutter through my mind. So if it's appropriate, if it's skillful, it can be healing for both parties. But certainly you're not under any obligation to do that. It's a question of would it be skillful? Because sometimes you might be like the last person in the world they want to show up. Right? You might be, and to show up and want anything back from them might be a harm to them again, right? Maybe they don't want to deal with you. Right? Nor are you obligated, if you're the person who's been harmed, nor are you obligated to have continued relationship with somebody or to pick up relationship with somebody again. And I think this is an area where people can be very confused. Because just because somebody has acknowledged harm and maybe contacted you or they're now back in your social circle, forgiveness doesn't necessarily mean you have to have a relationship with them. Right? That's not what's being called for, you know? If you have somebody who was your roommate and, you know, didn't pay rent for 6 months and, you know, you wound up nearly going bankrupt trying to not get evicted and, you know, now they're out socially in the same circles and you run across them and they want to go out and have dinner or something, you're not like obligated to do that. You don't have to pick up that type of relationship with somebody else again. You can just do your own internal work of letting go of the resentment and the anger that comes up for you every time you see them in, you know, what used to be your familiar haunt, right? So what this looks like for individual people doesn't necessarily all look the same. And in fact, there are some people, like some people who are dangerous or, you know, very, or psychologically destructive, or, you know, just their seal is just the same as it always was. It's always been bad, and it's still bad. They could be people that you're wise to avoid, right? You don't need to open up your life to every person. If you've learned something about somebody that causes your discernment to go, you know, that's really not a good idea, that one. So, you know, the nature of the whole enterprise is that we release the tie to others that has the nature of hatred, fear, resentment, guilt, or shame, right? And you may have some other tie to that person, or you may not have any tie to that person. But the whole purpose of the process is to use wisdom to release suffering, your suffering. So there's one other piece here. So one is talking again about the wisdom of discernment. And that is the wisdom of discernment versus guilt and shame. So there is a way in which we can take responsibility for our actions that's not skillful. Well, probably more than one way we can take responsibility that's not skillful. But just to say, if we use our moral failings as proof positive that we're bad and worthless human beings, this is not skillful, right? It's not skillful, ever skillful, to close our own hearts to ourselves. So we may have done unskillful things, we may have done harmful things, but that doesn't mean that that's our essence as human beings, or that that has like contaminated us for the rest of our lives or anything like that. And when the mind goes to the guilt and shame and it grabs it, really grasps it, not only is it not skillful, but it's self-centered in a particular kind of way, isn't it? Because instead of becoming clear about what behaviors we need to change and taking responsibility to do so, we collapse into a reverse narcissism, making it all about us, right? Oh, I'm so bad. I'm so bad. I've always been bad. It's like, I'm so badder than all the other bads. I'm the bad one, right? It's kind of like, I'm bad. So shame and guilt are suffering states, and to relate to them in unwholesome ways undercuts the real work, the work that needs to be done to liberate the mind and actually avoid future suffering. Because getting caught in guilt and shame disempowers the mind, and then it loses confidence in its potential to evolve to greater wisdom. So you're undermining your own capacity if you go down that chute, right? Because now you're a bad, unusually horrible kind of human being. So really, you don't have the tools to undertake what really needs to be done in order to free your mind from suffering in relationship to this situation. So that's taken the insight into the unskillfulness of particular actions, and then attaching that in a fixed way to a particular kind of negative self-view. Right? It's like, I am my bad actions. I am bad. So, if we can be open to the truth of what continued present suffering there is, then we see that this is a process again, right? It's not a one-time thing where you make this decision and then forgiveness happens. It's a process of continued engagement. So if you were to ask the question, well, how long does it take, or what's the continued engagement? I would say the continued engagement is until the suffering is gone, right? Until the dukkha is down to normal level human suffering instead of being in this special category that has such power to disturb our minds and to wound us. So even if you've come to a lot of internal clarity about the wisdom of forgiveness, you want to reframe your relationship to this suffering arising as a tail on to unskillful actions by yourself or others, that doesn't mean that you might not still continue to have real-time arising of things that you need to work with. Things like anger or sadness or fear or remorse or guilt. So we learn to work with these with love without closing around them or identifying with them. So there's a certain kind of way, they're like a karmic residue of this event or events. A kind of space junk that's still orbiting from an initial collision which is now over, right? You ever see these situations like where, you know, a rocket hit an asteroid or something and it blew it up into pieces? Okay, it's blown up into pieces now. But every so often, just because of how things orbit around the Earth every so often. There's that meteor shower again. Here it comes again. Well, some of the dukkha-related, these circumstances are a little bit like that, right? Every once in a while, you may still have a meteor shower. It may still be coming through the orbit. So we commit to work with these difficult states in a way that supports our liberation. And that might involve getting not just practice support, but also support and training in methods like psychotherapy or somatic experiencing, which can support the body and mind to let go. So maybe we need to commit to sobriety, enter treatment, something like that, right? That's part of the story. So that's my take on the process, right? That it's a wisdom question, and you can see when I initially was discussing this in terms of sama sampajana, it really requires a kind of overview intelligence about what the different elements are of this in order to figure out how to proceed. Because it's not a simple one-off thing like saying, I forgive you, or will you forgive me? I mean, it's nice if you have that kind of verbal thing. That doesn't necessarily in itself mean anything or fix anything, right? The real question is, how do you relate to the dukkha of it? The dukkha of it when it arises in real time. How do you understand what will actually reduce your suffering and the suffering of others when this arises or re-arises or reoccurs in your mind stream from time to time? So that's what I think. What are we doing here? And that about takes our time. So we'll have time in the next few days to talk about this in specifics if people want to do that. But I think for now that's enough. Right. So may the wholesome act of offering and hearing the Dharma be a cause and condition for our own awakening and for that of all beings everywhere. May we all find freedom and peace.